chicken. Someone like us. And she appeared, I could see from her picture, as a young Indian maiden, dark, just like me. On her feast day in early December, my family would go to the Mexican church for a pre-dawn high mass. The celebration would begin in the cold dark with a blare of trumpets imitating the cries of a cock. The Virgin's wavering statue on the shoulders of men would lead a procession into the warm yellow church. Often an usher would roughly separate me from my parents and pull me into a line of young children. My mother nodded calmly when I looked back. Sometimes alone, sometimes with my brother and sisters, I would find myself near the altar amid 200 or 300 children, many of them dressed like Mexican cowboys and cowgirls. Sitting on the floor, it was easier to see the congregation than the altar. So, as the mass progressed, my eye would wander through the crowd. Invariably, my attention settled on old women, mysterious supplicants in black, bent deep, their hands clasped tight to hold steady the attention of the Mexican Virgin, who was pictured high over the altar astride a black moon. The Gringo Catholic Church, a block from our house, was a very different place. In the Gringo Church, Mary's statue was relegated to a side altar, imaged there as a serene white lady, who matter-of-factly squashed the Genesis serpent with her bare feet. Very early I knew that I was supposed to believe that the shy Mexican Mary was the same as this European Mary triumphant. In the Gringo Church, the floors were made not of squeaky wood but of marble, and there was not the devotional clutter of so many pictures and statues and candle racks. "It doesn't feel like a church," my mother complained. But as it became our regular church, I grew to love its elegant simplicity, the formal march of its 8 black pillars toward the altar, the Easter egg-shaped sanctuary that arched high over the tabernacle, and the dim pink lights suffused throughout our summer afternoons when I came in not to pray, but to marvel at the cool calm. The holy darkness of church never frightened me. It was never nighttime darkness. Religion at school and at church was never nighttime religion like religion at home. Catholicism at home was shaped by the sounds of the family rosary. Tired voices repeating the syllables of the Hail Mary, our fingers inching forward on beads toward the point of beginning, my knees aching the coming of sleep. Religion at home was a religion of bedtime. Prayers before sleeping spoke of death coming during the night. It was then a religion of shadows. The last thing I'd see before closing my eyes would be the cheap statue of Mary aglow next to my bed. But the dark at the foot of my bed billowed with malevolent shapes. Those nights, when I'd shudder awake from a nightmare, I'd remember my grandmother's instruction to make a sign of the cross in the direction of my window. That way Satan would find his way barred. Sitting up in bed, I'd aim the sign of the cross against the dim rectangle of light. Quickly then I'd say the prayer to my guardian angel, which would enable me to fall back to sleep. In time, dawn came. A child whose parents could not introduce him to books like Grimm's fairy tales, I was introduced to the spheres of enchantment by the nighttime Catholicism of demons and angels. The superstitious Catholicism of home provided a kind of proletarian fairy tale world. Satan was mentioned in the classroom and depicted on the nuns' cartoon placards as bringing all his evil to bear on the temptation of nicely dressed boys and girls. In the morning's bright light and in the safe company of classmates, Satan never aroused very much terror. Around the time I was in fourth grade, moreover, religion classes became increasingly academic. I was introduced to that text familiar to generations of Catholic students, the Baltimore Catechism. It is a text organized by questions about the Catholic faith. Who is God? What is penance? What is hope? Today's Catholic elementary schools attempt a less mechanical approach to religious instruction. Students are taught, what I never had to be taught, that religion is not simply a matter of dogmas or theological truths, that religion involves a person's whole way of life. To make the point, emphasis has shifted from the theological to the ethical. Students are encouraged to consider social problems and responses to practical dilemmas in a modern world through which angels and devils no longer dance. My schooling belonged to another time. The Baltimore Catechism taught me to trust the authority of the Church. That was the central lesson conveyed through the experience of memorizing hundreds of questions and answers. I learned an answer like, God made us to know, love, and serve Him in this life, and to be happy with Him in the next. The answer was memorized along with the question, it belonged with the question, why did God make us? I learned, in other words, question and answer together. Beyond what the answer literally stated, two things were thus communicated. First, the existence of a question implies the existence of an answer. There are no stray questions. And second, that my questions about religion had answers. The Church knows. Not only in religion class was memory exercised. During those years when I was memorizing the questions and answers of the Baltimore Catechism, I was also impressing on my memory the spelling of hundreds of words, grammar rules, division and multiplication tables. The nuns deeply trusted the role of memorization in learning. Not coincidentally, they were excellent teachers of basics. They would stand in front of the room for hours, drilling us over and over. 5 times 5, 5 times 9, I before E, except after C. God made us to know, love, and serve Him in this world. Stressing memorization, my teachers implied that education is largely a matter of acquiring knowledge already discovered. And they were right. For contrary to more progressive notions of learning, much that is learned in a classroom must be the already known. And much that is already known must be learned before a student can achieve truly independent thought. Stressing memorization, the nuns assumed an important Catholic bias. Stated positively, they believed that learning is a social activity, learning is a rite of passage in the group. Remembrance is itself an activity that establishes a student's dependence upon and union with others. Less defensively, the nuns distrusted intellectual challenges to authority. In religion class especially, they would grow impatient with the relentlessly questioning student. When one nun told my parents that their youngest daughter had a mind of her own, she meant the remark to be a negative criticism. And even though I was urged to read all that I could, several teachers were dismayed to learn that I had read the novels of Victor Hugo and Flaubert. Those writings are on the index, Richard. With classmates, I would hear the nuns warning about non-Catholic colleges, stories of Faustian Catholics falling victim to the foolish sin of intellectual pride. Trust the Church. It was the institution established by the instruction of Christ to His disciple. Thou art Peter, and upon this rock I will build. How could Protestants not hear? The nun drew her pointer to the chart in front of the classroom where the line of popes connected the name of St. Peter to that of Pope Pius XII. Trust the Church, the nun said. It was through the Church that God was best known. I came to believe. I am a Catholic. My faith in the Christian God was enclosed by my faith in the Church. I never read the Bible alone. In fifth grade, when I told a teacher that I intended to read the New Testament over the summer, I did not get the praise I expected. Instead, the nun looked worried and said, I should delay my plan for a while. Wait until we read it in class. In the seventh and eighth grades, my class finally did read portions of the Bible. We read together, and our readings were guided by the teachings of tradition. The continuous interpretation of the word passing through generations of Catholics. Thus, as a reader, I never forgot the ancient Catholic faith that the Church serves to help solitary man comprehend God's Word. 2. Of all the institutions in their lives, only the Catholic Church has seemed aware of the fact that my mother and father are thinkers. Persons aware of the experience of their lives. Other institutions, the nation's political parties, the industries of mass entertainment and communications, the companies that employed them, have all treated my parents with condescension. The church, too, has treated them badly when it attempted formal instruction. The homily at Sunday Mass, intended to give parishioners basic religious instruction, has often been poorly prepared and aimed at a childish listener. It has been the liturgical church that has excited my parents. In ceremonies of public worship, they have been moved, assured that their lives, all aspects of their lives, from waking to eating, from birth until death, all moments, possess great significance. Only the liturgy has encouraged them to dwell on the meaning of their lives, to think. What the church gave to my mother and father, it gave to me. During those years when the nuns warned me about the dangers of intellectual pride and referred to Christ as baby Jesus, they were enabling me to participate fully in the liturgical life of the church. The nuns were not interested in constructing a temple of religious abstractions. God was more than an idea. He was person, white-bearded, with big arms. Pictures could not show what he really was like, the nun said. But one could be sure that he was our Father. He loved us, and we were to respond like children in love. Our response would be prayer. In my first grade classroom, I learned to make the sign of the cross with English words. In addition to prayers said at home, prayers before dinner and before sleeping, there were prayers in the classroom. A school day was divided by prayer. First, the morning offering. At 10:15 before recess, the prayer to my guardian angel. At noontime, the Angelus in celebration of the word. The angel of the Lord declared unto Mary. After lunch came the creed. And before going home, the act of contrition. In first grade, I was taught to make the sign of the cross when I entered the church, and how to genuflect, the right knee bending and touching all the way to the floor. And the nuns told us of the most perfect prayer, Christ's offering of his body and blood to the Father, the sacrifice of the Mass. Alongside red, yellow, blue, green, Dick and Jane was disclosed to us the knowledge of our immortal souls, and that our souls, we were Catholics, needed the special nourishment of the Church, the Mass and the sacraments. In second grade, at the age of 7, we were considered by the Church to have reached the age of reason. We were supposed capable of distinguishing good from evil. We were able to sin, able to ask forgiveness for sin. In second grade, I was prepared for my first confession, which took place on a Saturday morning in May. With all my classmates, I went to the unlit church where the nun led us through the forms of an examination of conscience. Then, one by one, as we would be summoned to judgment after death, we entered the airless confessional. The next day, spotless souls, we walked as a class up the aisle of the church, the girls in white dresses and veils like small brides, the boys in white pants and white shirts. We walked to the altar rail where the idea of God assumed a shape and a scent and a taste. As an 8-year-old Catholic, I learned the names and functions of all 7 sacraments. I knew why the priest put glistening oil on my grandmother's forehead the night she died. At the baptismal font, I watched a baby cry out as the priest trickled a few drops of cold water on his tiny red forehead. At 10, I knew the meaning of the many ritual gestures the priest makes during the Mass. I knew by heart the drama of feast days and seasons, and could read the significance of changing altar cloth colors as the year slowly rounded. The church rocked through time, a cradle, an ark, to rhythms of sorrow and joy, marking the passage of man. The Catholic calendar in my bedroom was printed by W.H. Gormley and Sons, morticians. Every month there was a different Bible picture in beautiful colors. Every day was something. The calendar noted ferial and ember days, fish days and the feast days of saints. My birthday honored St. Ignatius Loyola. There was another, a regular calendar in the kitchen, capital savings and loan. It noted full moons and crescents and the official change of the seasons. My mother used the regular calendar to write down our doctor's appointments, shots, T teeth. It was the religious calendar that governed my school year. In early September, there was a 9 o'clock mass on the Friday of the first week of school to pray for academic success. Students were grouped according to class. Behind my class would be my new teacher's face, a face I still wasn't used to. In June, there was a mass of graduation for the eighth graders. Between those events, school often stopped or flowered as routine bowed to the sacred. In the middle of a geography or an arithmetic lesson, the nuns would lead us out of our classrooms and we would walk, 400 students in double lines, down a block to church, stopping traffic. We were Catholics, to attend the First Friday Mass or Rosary to Mary. In Lent, there were Friday Stations of the Cross, 14 meditations on the Passion of Christ. He stumbled, he fell, 14 times the priest intoning, "We adore thee, O Christ." Benediction, the adoration of the host, followed. The lovely hymn, the Tantum Ergo, sounded as smoke of incense rose like vine. Upon the high altar stood a golden monstrance in the shape of a sunburst, at the center of which, exposed through a tiny window, was the round wafer of bread. We returned to the classroom, came back to the same paragraph in a still-opened book. Routine resumed. Sacred dramas of church thus fitted into a day. Never became the routine. Rather, they redeemed the routine. On Halloween night, all over Sacramento, children dressed up as ghosts or Frankensteins or dime store skeletons with phosphorescent bones. But only Catholic school kids went to Mass the next morning to honor the white-robed saints and the Feast of All Hallows. It was one of the holy days of obligation, a day on which I was obliged to go to morning Mass. But for the rest of the day, I was free, no school. I could ride my bicycle around Sacramento, watch public school kids walking to school. And people downtown were passing just another day. They seemed not to know. In the secular calendar, there was no day like Ash Wednesday. All day I would see on the heedless foreheads of classmates the Hindu-like smudge of dark ash, the reminder of death, unto dust thou shalt return. One year a girl at school was killed in a car crash shortly after Ash Wednesday. I took the lesson. On those few occasions when secular Sacramento took up the sacred calendar, they got it all wrong. Christmas downtown began in early November. Merchants would string tiny white lights up over K Street, where they shone through the night as pretty as heaven. But their Christmas ended in late afternoon on Christmas Eve. I saw department store clerks working against time to replace a holiday window display with deathly white piles of towels and sheets. In church in early November, there was Advent, the time for penance. On a table in front of the altar was a wreath with four candles stuck in, one of which was lit each week to mark the coming, the slow, slow coming of Christ. In church, Christmas began at midnight Mass, Christmas Eve, and the holy season continued until the Feast of Epiphany, the 6th of January, when carols were sung for the very last time and fir trees on the altar no longer cast their dark scent of damp earth. The secular calendar whirled like a carnival wheel and offered carnival prizes. A fat Santa instead of the infant God, colored eggs and chocolate bunnies instead of the death and resurrection of Christ. During Holy Week, all pictures and statues in church were shrouded by purple silk drapes. On Holy Thursday, to commemorate the Last Supper of Christ, there was a white mass at sunset, when stained glass windows burned briefly before the light failed. After that mass, the sacrament was removed to a side altar and the red sanctuary lamp was extinguished so that the next day, Good Friday, when women in scarves and men in work clothes came to church for the 3 hours, they found an altar stripped bare and the tabernacle gaping. In our house on Good Friday, we behaved as if a member of our family had died. There was no radio or television. But I noticed that the Standard gas station right across from church stayed open for business as usual, and I saw people at the laundromat watching their clothes tumble behind a round window, as if nothing in the world had happened. In Sacramento, the blue Easter morning seemed always to rhyme with the gospel account of the three Marys wending their way through a garden to discover an empty tomb. At church, at the altar, There were vestments of gold and the climbing voices of a Mozart mass, tossing rings sempiternal. The wheels turned, two wheels of time. The secular calendar made plain note of the hot first day of summer, fall, then winter. Ordinary time, Labor Day, the first day of school, arithmetic class, an hour for spelling, a test every Friday, recess, church time, benediction with classmates, candles on St. Blaise's Day, ash, palms in April, the red-eyed white dove descending on Pentecost Sunday, Mary crowned with dying sweet flowers on the first day of May, the wheels turned, second grade, third grade, fifth grade, Christmas, Epiphany. The secular calendar announced the vernal equinox. The low valley fog of late winter would slowly yield to the coming of Easter. I went to the 9 o'clock mass every Sunday with my family, and that time in my life when I was so struck by diminished family closeness and the necessity of public life, church was a place unlike any other. It mediated between my public and private lives. I would kneel beside my brother and sisters. On one side of us would be my mother. I could hear her whispered Spanish Hail Mary. On the other side, my father. In the pew directly in front of us were the Van Hoyts, and in front of them were the druggist and his family. Over to the side was a lady who wore fancy dresses, a widow who prayed a crystal rosary. She was alone, as was the old man in front who cupped his face in his hands while he prayed. It was this same gesture of privacy the nuns would teach me to use, especially after communion when I thanked God for coming into my soul. The Mass mystified me for being a public and a private event. We prayed here, each of us, much as we prayed on our pillows, most privately, all alone before God. And yet the great public prayer of the Mass would go on. No one ever forgot where they were. People stood up together or they knelt at the right time in response to the progression of the liturgy. Every Sunday in summer, someone fainted from the heat, had to be carried out, but the Mass went on. I remember being puzzled very early by how different things were for the Protestants. Evangelical Christians would ring the doorbell to ask bluntly whether or not I was saved. They proceeded to tell me about their own conversions to Christ. From classmates, I would hear about holy rollers who jumped up and down and even fell to the floor at their services. It was funny, hard to believe. My religion, the true religion, was so different. On Sunday afternoons, for a guilty few minutes, I'd watch an Oral Roberts prayer meeting on television. Members of the congregation made public confessions of sin while people off camera shouted, "Hallelujah, sister! Hallelujah, brother! Preach it!" Sister and brother were terms I used in speaking to my teachers for 12 years. Father was the name for the priest at church. I never confused my teachers or the priests with actual family members. In fact, they were most awesome for being without families. Yet I came to use these terms with ease. They implied that a deep bond existed between my teachers and me as fellow Catholics. At the same time, however, sister and father were highly formal terms of address. They were titles, marks of formality, like a salute or a curtsy. One would never have spoken to a nun without first calling her sister. It was possible, consequently, to use these terms and to feel at once a close bond and the distance of formality. In a way, that is how I felt with all fellow Catholics in my world. We were close, somehow related, while also distanced by careful reserve. Not once in all the years of my Catholic schooling did I hear a classmate or teacher make a public confession. Public confessions were whispered through darkness to the shadow of a priest sworn to secrecy. Never once did I hear a classmate or teacher make an exclamation of religious joy. Religious feelings and faith were channeled through ritual. Thus it was that my classmates and I prayed easily throughout the school day. We recited sublime prayers and childish ones, Angel of God, my guardian dear, and nobody snickered, because the prayers were always the same and because they were said by the group, we had a way of praying together without being self-conscious. Children of ceremony. My classmates and I would rehearse our roles before major liturgical celebrations. Several days before a feast day, we would learn the movements for a procession. In the half-darkened church, one nun stood aside with a wooden clapper, which she knocked to tell us when to rise, when to kneel, when to leave the pew, when to genuflect all together. We'd rehearse marching, the tallest last, up the aisle in straight, careful lines. Worship was managed as ceremony. My sense of belonging in this ceremonial church was dearest when I turned 12 and became an altar boy. Dressed in a cassock like a priest's, I assisted at the performance of Mass on the altar. It was my responsibility to carry the heavy red missal back and forth from one side of the altar to the other, to pour water and sweet-scented wine into the priest's chalice, to alert the congregation with a handbell at the Sanctus and at the elevation of the host. But by far the greatest responsibility was to respond to the priest in memorized Latin prayers. I served as the voice of the congregation, sounding, all told, perhaps 100 responsorial lines. Latin, the nuns taught us, was a universal language. One could go into a Catholic church anywhere in the world and hear the very same Mass. But Latin was also a dead language, a tongue foreign to most Catholics. As an altar boy, I memorized Latin in blank envelopes of sound. Adeum qui lei ti ficat uventutem meum. Many of the ordinary prayers of the Mass were generally recognizable to me. Any Catholic who used a bilingual missal could, after a while, recognize the meaning of whole prayers, like the Credo. I had the advantage of being able to hear in the shrouded gallery of Latin sounds echoes of Spanish words familiar to me. Listening to a priest, I could often grasp the general sense of what he was saying, but I didn't always try to. In part, Latin permitted escape from the prosaic world. Latin's great theatrical charm, its sacred power, was that it could translate human aspiration to a holy tongue. The Latin Mass, moreover, encouraged private reflection. The sounds of Latin would sometimes blur my attention to induce an aimless drift inward. But then I would be called back by the priest's voice, Oremus, to public prayer, the reminder that an individual has the aid of the Church in his life. I was relieved of the burden of being alone before God through my membership in the church. Parish priests recognized and encouraged my fascination with the liturgy. During the last 3 years of grammar school, I was regularly asked to serve as an altar boy. In my busiest year, eighth grade, I served at over 200 masses. I must have served at about 30 baptisms and about the same number of weddings and funerals. During the school year, I was excused from class for an hour or two to serve at a funeral mass. In summertime, I would abandon adolescence to put the black cassock of mourning over a light summer shirt. A spectator at so many funerals, I grew acquainted with the rhythms of grief. I knew at which moments, at which prayers in church and at gravesides, survivors were most likely to weep. I studied faces. I learned to trust the grief of persons who showed no emotion. With the finesse of a mortician, I would lead mourners to the grave. I helped carry coffins, their mysterious weight, neither heavy nor light, to burial sites when there were not mourners enough. And then I would return, to class or to summer, resume my life as a boy of 13. There are people who tell me today that they are not religious because they consider religion to be an evasion of life. I hear them, their assurance, and do not bother to challenge the arrogance of a secular world which hasn't courage enough to accept the fact of old age and death. I know people who speak of death with timorous euphemisms of passing away. I have friends who wouldn't think of allowing their children to attend a funeral for fear of inflicting traumatic scars. For my part, I will always be grateful to the church that took me so seriously and exposed me so early through the liturgy to the experience of life. I will always be grateful to the parish priest who forced a mortician to remove an elaborate arrangement of flowers from a coffin. Don't hide it. I celebrate now a childhood lived through the forms of the liturgical church. As the church filled my life, I grew to the assurance that my life, my every action and thought was important for good or for bad. Bread and wine, water, oil, salt, and ash, through ceremonies of guilt and redemption, sorrow and rebirth, through the passing liturgical year, my boyhood assumed all significance. I marvel most at having so easily prayed with others, not simply alone. I recall standing at the altar at Easter amid candles and gold vestments, hearing the Mozart High Mass. These were impossible riches. I remember wanting to cry out with joy, to shout. I wanted to shout. But I didn't, of course. I worshipped in a ceremonial church, one in a group. I remained silent and remembered to genuflect exactly on cue. After the Mass, I pulled off the surplice and cassock and rushed to meet my parents, waiting for me in front of the church. "It was very nice today," my mother said. Something like that. It makes you feel good. The beautiful music and everything. That was all that she said. It was enough. 3. Now, I go to Mass every Sunday. Old habits persist. But it is an English Mass I attend. A ritual of worlds. A ritual that seeks to feed my mind and would starve my somewhat metaphorical soul. The Mass is less ornamental. It has been modernized, tampered with, demythologized, deflated. The priest performs fewer gestures. His central role as priest, intermediary between congregation and God, is diminished. Symbols have changed. A reciprocal relationship between people and clergy is dramatized as the congregation takes an active role in the recitation of the Mass. The priest faces the people, his back to the tabernacle. And the effect of this rearrangement is to make the Mass seem less a prayer directed to God, more a communal celebration of the Eucharist. There is something occasional about it all, and no occasion for pomp or solemnity. No longer is the congregation moved to a contemplation of the timeless. Rather, it is the idiomatic one hears. One's focus is upon this place, this time, the moment, now. In the old Latin Mass, my mother could recite her rosary while still being at one with prayer at the altar. The new English Mass is unilinear, lacking density. There is little opportunity for private prayer. The English words enforce attention. Emphasis is on the communal prayer, communal identity. There is a moment just before the communion when members of the congregation shake hands to dramatize a union. We nod and bow, shake hands like figures on a music box. I go along with the kiss of peace, but paradoxically I feel isolated sitting in half-empty churches among people I am suddenly aware of not knowing. The kiss signifies to me a betrayal of the older ceremonial liturgy. I miss that high ceremony. I am saddened by inappropriate music about which it is damning enough to say that it is not good enough and not even the best of its authentic kind, folk, pop, quasi-religious Broadway show tunes. I miss the old trappings, trappings that disclosed a different reality. I have left church early, walked out after hearing the congregation spontaneously applaud its own singing. And I have wondered how the church I loved could have changed so quickly and completely. I continue to claim my Catholicism. Invariably, I arrive late at somebody's brunch or tennis party, the festivities of a secular Sunday. Friends find it peculiar that I still go to Mass. Most have heard me complain about liturgical changes. Amid the orange juice and croissants, I burlesque the folk Mass liturgy, Kumbaya, the peppy tambourine. Those listening find my sarcasm amusing. And someone says that my Catholicism is a mere affectation, an attempt to play the Evelyn Waugh eccentric to a bland and vulgar secular age. I am not surprised. I do not know myself, not with any certainty, how much I really am saying when I profess Catholicism. In a cultural sense, I remain a Catholic. My upbringing has shaped in me certain attitudes which have not worn thin over the years. I am, for example, a materialist, largely because I was brought up to believe in the central mystery of the Church, the redemptive incarnation. I carried the heavy gold crucifix in church ceremonies far too often to share the distrust of the material still prevalent in modern Puritan America. I am a man who trusts a society that is carefully ordered by figures of authority. I respond to policemen in the same tone of voice I used years ago, addressing parish priests and nuns. I realize that I am a Catholic, moreover, when I listen skeptically to a political thinker describe with enthusiasm a scheme for lasting political change. My historical pessimism was determined by grammar school lessons about sin, especially original sin. More important than any of this, I continue to believe the central tenets of the Church. I stand at the Creed of the Mass. Though it is exactly then, at that very moment in the liturgy, when I must realize how different the Church has become in recent years. I stand as a stranger among strangers. For the truth is, it is not only the Church that has changed. I have changed as well. My Catholicism changed when I was in high school. The liturgy was just then beginning to be altered. It was not simply that I found a different church when I went to church. I went to church less often. My high school was not connected to a neighborhood church the way my grammar school had been. There were consequently few school days interrupted by worship. Liturgy was something for Sunday. My high school, staffed by the Christian Brothers, offered a more Protestant education. My freshman literature teacher only smiled when I mentioned the grammar school incident concerning Flaubert. He and other high school teachers encouraged my intellectual independence. Religious instruction became rigorously intellectual. With excitement, I'd study complex Pauline and Thomistic theology, and I'd remember with something like scorn the simple instructions of the Baltimore Catechism. In high school, I started saying that I believed in Catholicism. My faith was buttressed by a book by Jacques Maritain, rather than by the experience of worship at a Lenten service with classmates or serving at some old lady's funeral. Those years were marked by the realization that my parents assumed a Catholicism very different from mine. My parents seemed to me piously simple, like the nuns I remembered, unwilling to entertain intellectual challenges. They would rely on their rosary every night, while in another room I read patristic theology. In college, I had few Catholic friends and fewer Catholic teachers. Most of my friends had been raised as Protestants or Jews. Many referred to themselves as agnostics. During my college years, I started reading Protestant theology. The Church was no longer my sole spiritual teacher. I blended Catholicism with borrowed insights from Sartre and Zen and Buber and Miltonic Protestantism and Freud. I was a senior at Stanford during the last year of the Vatican Council. I cheered for the liberal bishops and cardinals at the Great Convocation. The villains, in my view, were the conservatives of the Roman Curia. I welcomed the Church's attempts at reconciliation with other religions. I approved of the liberal encyclicals concerning the Church in the modern world. But I was changing rather more quickly than the Council Fathers were changing the Church. I was already a new Catholic. I didn't wait for the American bishops to terminate the observance of meatless Fridays before I ate what looked best in the dormitory cafeteria on Friday nights. Nor did I request a dispensation from a priest when a non-Catholic friend asked me to be his best man. I simply agreed and stood beside him in a Methodist church. I would go to friends for advice when I was troubled. I didn't go to priests anymore. I stopped going to confession, not because my behavior conflicted with the teachings of the institutional church, but because I no longer thought to assess my behavior against those standards. A Catholic who lived most of his week without a sense of communal Catholicism, I relied upon a conscience as never before. The priest, who was the college chaplain, would regularly say in his sermons that a Catholic must rely upon conscience as his ultimate guide. It seemed so to me. But I remember feeling uneasy when the priest was later excommunicated for having been secretly married. Throughout college and graduate school, I thought of myself as an Orthodox Catholic. I was a liberal Catholic. In all things save the liturgy, I was a liberal. From the start, I despised the liturgical reformation. In college chapels, I would listen to folk singing and see plain altars draped with bright appliqué banners, "Joy, God is love." One Sunday, I would watch dancers in leotards perform some kind of ballet in front of the altar. One Sunday, there would be a rock mass. One Sunday, the priest encouraged us to spend several minutes before the offertory introducing ourselves, while a small bad jazzy combo punched out a cocktail mix. I longed for the Latin Mass. Incense, music of Bach, ceremonies of candles and acolytes. Over the last several years, I have visited many Catholic churches in the several cities I have lived in: Palo Alto, New York, Berkeley, Los Angeles, London, San Francisco. I have wandered on Sundays from church to church. But in all the churches, I have had to listen to the new English Mass, the proclamation of faith, the creed I hear recited by the congregation around me. We believe in God. In the abandoned Latin service, it was the priest alone who spoke the affirmation of faith. It was the priest who said, "Credo," using the first person singular. The differences between the old service and the new can be summarized in this change. At the old Mass, the priest's credo, "I believe," complexly reminded the congregation of the fact that each person stands before God as an individual, implying at the same time, because the priest could join all voices in his, the union of believers, the consolation of communal faith, the listener was assured of his membership in the church. He was not alone before God. The church would assist him. By translating credo into the English first-person plural, "we believe," the church no longer reminds the listener that he is alone. "We believe," the congregation is encouraged to say, celebrating community. But only that fact. I would protest this simplification of the liturgy if I could. I would protest as well the diminished sense of the sacred in churches today. I would protest the use of folk music and the hand-holding. Finally, I cannot. I suspect that the reason I despise the new liturgy is because it is mine. It reflects and attempts to resolve the dilemma of Catholics just like me. The informal touches, the handshaking, the folk music, the insistence upon union, all these changes are aimed at serving Catholics who no longer live in a Catholic world. To such Catholics, increasingly alone in their faith, the Church says, "You are part of a community of believers. You are not single in your faith, not solitary. We are together, Catholics. We believe. We believe. We believe." This assurance is necessary because, in a sense, it no longer is true. The Catholic Church of my past required no such obvious reminders of community as smiles and handshakes before the communion. The old Mass proceeded with sure, blind pomp precisely because Catholics had faith in their public identity as Catholics. The old liturgy was ceremonial because of the Church's assumption that worship is a public event. The lack of high ceremony in church today betrays a loss of faith in communal Catholicism. In obvious ways, everyone in the congregation seems closer and more aware of each other. As a group, throughout Mass, the congregation responds to the priest with various prayers. One listens to a steady flow of prayers said in English. But there is scant opportunity for private prayer. The church cannot dare it. A priest I once heard in a white middle-class parish defended the Reformed liturgy by saying that it had become necessary to de-Europeanize the Roman Catholic Church. He said that Catholicism must translate God's word into the many languages and cultures of the world. I suppose he is right. I do not think, however, that the primary impetus for liturgical reformation came from third-world Catholics. I think rather that it came in response to a middle-class crisis of faith in North America and Western Europe. The new liturgy is suited especially to those who live in the secular city, alone in their faith for most of the week. It is not a liturgy suited to my parents or grandparents as much as to me. When I go to church on Sunday, I am forced to recognize a great deal about myself. I would rather go to a high ceremonial mass, reap for an hour or two its communal assurance. The sentimental solution would be ideal, to remain a liberal Catholic and to worship at a traditional mass. But now that I no longer live as a Catholic in a Catholic world, I cannot expect the liturgy, which reflects and cultivates my faith, to remain what it was. I will continue to go to the English Mass. I will go because it is my liturgy. I will, however, often recall with nostalgia the faith I have lost. And I will be uneasy knowing that the old faith was lost as much by choice as it was inevitably lost. My education may have made it inevitable that I would become a citizen of the secular city, but I have come to embrace the city's values: social mobility, pluralism, egalitarianism, self-reliance. By choice, I do not confine myself to Catholic society. Most of my friends and nearly all of my intimates are non-Catholics. With them, I normally will observe the politesse of secular society concerning religion, say nothing about it. By choice, I do not pray before eating lunch in a downtown restaurant. My public day is not divided by prayer. By choice, I do not consult the movie ratings of the Legion of Decency, and my reading is not curtailed by the index. By choice, I am ruled by conscience. Rather than the authority of priests, I consider my equals. I do not listen to papal pronouncements with which I disagree. Recently, bishops and popes, who have encouraged liturgical reforms, have seemed surprised at the insistence of so many Catholics to determine for themselves the morality of such matters as divorce, homosexuality, contraception, abortion, and extramarital sex. But the Church Fathers who initiated rituals that reflect a shared priesthood of laity and clergy should not be surprised by the independence of modern Catholics. The authoritarian Church belonged to another time. It was an upper-class church. It was a lower-class church. It was a hierarchical church. It was my grandparents' church. If I ask questions about religion that my grandparents didn't ask, it is not because I am intellectually advanced. I wonder about the existence of God because, unlike my grandparents, I live much of my day in a secular city where I do not measure the hours with the tolling bells of a church. As a boy, I believed in God by believing in His church. Now that my faith in communal Catholicism is so changed, my faith in God is without certain foundation. It occurs to me to ask that profound question of modern agnosticism: is God dead? I would cry into the void. If I should lose my faith in God, I would have no place to go to where I could feel myself a man. The Catholic Church of my youth mediated with special grace between the public and private realms of my life. Such was the extent of its faith in itself. That church is no longer mine. I cling to the new Catholic Church, though it leaves me unsatisfied. I fear giving it up, falling through space. Even in today's Catholic Church, it is possible for me to feel myself in the eye of God while I kneel in the presence of others. If God is dead, where shall I go for such an experience? In this modern post-religious age, secular institutions flounder to imitate the gift that is uniquely found in the temple and mosque and church. Secular institutions lack the key. They have no basis for claiming access to the realm of the private. When they try to deny their limits, secular institutions only lie. They pretend that there is no difference between public and private life. The worst are totalitarian governments. They respect no notion of privacy. They intrude into a family's life. They ignore the individual's right to be private. They would bulldoze the barrier separating the public from the private. They create the modern nightmare of institutional life. If God is dead, I will cry into the void. There was a time in my life when it would never have occurred to me to make a confession like this one. There was a time when I would never have thought to discuss my spiritual life, even with other Catholics I knew intimately. It is true that in high school I read Augustine's Confessions, but that extraordinary autobiography did not prompt my imitation. Just the reverse. There seemed to me something non-Catholic about the Confessions. I intuited that such revelations made Augustine a Protestant church father more than a Catholic father. Years after, in college, I remember reading the diaries of 17th-century Puritans. To encounter simple people, a tradesman, a housewife, a farmer, describing their spiritual lives in detail amazed me. The Protestant confession was boldly different from the Catholic sacrament of confession. The Protestants were public about their spiritual lives in a way that I, as a Catholic schoolboy, could never have been. Protestants were so public because they were otherwise alone in their faith. I marveled at the paradox implied by their writings. Those early, pure English Protestants, strangers to ceremony and for their own reasons alien from the institutional church, were attempting to form through their writings a new kind of Christian community, a community of those who share with each other only the experience of standing alone before God. It was then that I began to realize the difference separating the individualistic Protestant from the institutional Catholic. Now I realize that I have become like a Protestant Christian. I call myself a Christian. My own Catholic Church in recent years has become more like a Protestant church. Perhaps Protestants will teach Catholics like me how to remain believers when the sense one has for so much of one's day is of being alone in faith. If, in fact, my spiritual fathers are those 17th century Puritans, there is one important difference between their writings and mine. I am writing about my religious life, aware that most of my readers do not consider themselves religious. With them, with you, I am making this admission of faith. It is appropriate that I do so. The resolution of my spiritual dilemma, if there is to be one before death, will have to take place where it began, among persons who do not share my religious convictions. Persons like my good friends now, those who, smiling, wonder why I am more than an hour late for their Sunday brunch. Chapter 4. Complexion. Visiting the East Coast or the gray capitals of Europe during the long months of winter, I often meet people at deluxe hotels who comment on my complexion. In such hotels, it appears nowadays a mark of leisure and wealth to have a complexion like mine. Have I been skiing in the Swiss Alps? Have I just returned from a Caribbean vacation? No. I say no softly, but in a firm voice that intends to explain, my complexion is dark. My skin is brown, more exactly terracotta in sunlight, tawny in shade.